Do counsel have any questions about the written instructions? All right, at this time, I would ask everyone present in the courtroom to please turn off all electronic devices that make noise, including telephones, pagers, Blackberries, etc. And counsel, when you approach the podium, please state your name clearly and state your bar number before proceeding with argument. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Goodman. Bar number is 24573. I represent Richard and Loretta Day. With me today in court is Loretta Day. I'm going to concentrate on two of the three issues that I have raised in my briefs. And the first issue involves the question of a juror who's, we had a challenge for cause, and that challenge was denied, and that was juror number 14, Nurse Mann. I'm also going to concentrate on the jury instruction issue. On the first issue, it's fundamental that there is a right to an impartial jury. And in furtherance of the right, there are certain limitations as to who may serve as a juror, and Rule 47E sets forth who may be challenged for cause. In DuPont versus Preston, a division of this court stated that if a potential juror falls within one of the first five categories, then bias is inferred and they must be dismissed for cause. In this particular situation, we're looking at E5. And what E5 is has an interest in the outcome of the action. Juror 14 was an operating room nurse. The defendant in this medical malpractice case is a general surgeon. Juror 14, the nurse expressed that she was very concerned, she had some concern, or a little concern may have been her exact language, that if she were on this jury, that it could have implications for her future were she to return a verdict against Dr. Johnson. She's put in Hobson's choice came up earlier, she's put in a kind of a Hobson's choice. She's put in a position that if she is on this jury, she's got to go ahead and risk her own future in order to go ahead and find on behalf of the plaintiffs. Part of her statements were that this is a small town, that she has worked, she's new to the town, that she's worked in the operating room with one of the doctors who's going to be a witness in the case, and there's another doctor who's worked at the surgical center she's at. And there are two hospitals in this town, and she may want to work at those hospitals. And she was very diplomatic in how she approached things and said she didn't know if Dr. Johnson was somebody who would go ahead and do any sort of retaliation, but she had some concern. When she expresses that some concern, she is in that category five. She has indicated that her future is tied to the outcome of that case. And once that happens, she must be dismissed unless something happens to take her out of that category.
Mr. Goodman, may I ask you, please, the rule refers to an interest.
Correct.
In the action, but it doesn't define interest. And I've been looking to see what that means in the cases, and it seems to indicate a legal interest, not just whether you're interested in how it comes out. Can you please address that?
Well, I think it is more than a legal interest, because there are all the cases that are cited by the Dr. Johnson in the response brief. And those cases deal with interests like a creditor-debtor relationship not being enough, and state that that interest doesn't create that interest in the action because there is a clearly defined legal relationship between the two parties. I think putting a juror in the position of having to go ahead and place themselves in a position where they are at risk without a legal recourse puts her there. And I, if you can cite to me the particular case you're considering or cases you're considering, maybe I can address it more directly.
I'm just considering the cases that I've looked at Rule 47E, okay. And I haven't found any that particularly address the type of argument that you're making, which is I have potentially a future concern about the outcome of the litigation, but I don't see anything that indicates that that means you have an interest in the litigation such that 47E applies.
And I think the law under 47E5 is very unclear and very limited. I think that most of the cases where somebody has this kind of relationship or an interest in this action never make it this far because that juror, the challenge for cause is upheld. I think that part of what our justice system contemplates is that we don't put jurors into positions where they have to sacrifice what they see as their future interests in order to find for one party or the other, which is the position that this juror was put into.
How direct a link must there be between the juror and this future interest? In other words, could it be said that this juror is speculating about any possible future adverse ramifications?
Well, I think that it could be said, but I think to support that, there should have been something done on redirect to challenge that and to say, look, you don't know Dr. Johnson, and you don't know and can't say anything other than that maybe this could happen, and really, you have no basis to say that anything. But that never happened. What happened is there's a juror saying that she is concerned about this, and I think that puts her in the category, and that means she has to be off the jury.
What level of discomfort must a juror have to have a sufficient financial interest in the outcome of an action?
Well, I think that the juror has to have a sufficient, once the juror voices that interest, that I don't think it matters. I don't think that we can sit here as a society asking our jurors to say that this amount of sacrifice of your potential future is enough to keep you on the jury, and this amount of sacrifice of your potential future is the right amount. I think that it's a bright line rule that once a juror comes in and says, look, I'm in this category, I'm in this group, I'm in a special situation. I'm in a situation where I work and am subject to dealing with Dr. Johnson under Dr. Johnson, because she uses the term under Dr. Herzog. The nurses work under the physicians. And she expresses that she is concerned about that. Her concern is never attacked. Her concern is never raised that this is an unreasonable concern. It's never raised that this is an unfeasible or an improbable concern. Instead, the only thing that she's done with on the reexamination, the Dr. Johnson's voir dire, is questioned about whether she can put her medical judgment aside. There's never any questioning about whether she can put aside her concerns for her own future.
So she never disavows that?
She never disavows that.
Well, but would she have to if she doesn't fall under one of the categories for exclusion under 47E?
Well, I think that if we're going to look at it under, if you look at under 47E 1 through 5, I think that it's not necessarily discretionary in that. Under E 47, 6 through 7, well, again, if you're saying she's not under 47E at all, that this statement doesn't indicate any sort of bias or potential bias, then no, she doesn't. She doesn't have to disavow it. However, if this statement does in fact indicate bias, then yes, she does. And that would put under 47E6 and E7. And at that point, you'd be looking under the analysis of Vecchiarelli, McLaughlin, People versus Young, People versus Lumen, and People versus Wilson. And the question is going to be whether the entirety of that record indicates that she has gone ahead and shown that she doesn't have a bias. I don't think that applies in this situation. She has stated that she's used herself at risk, and I think it is unfair to put a prospective juror in that position and unfair to put a party in a position with that juror. The challenge for cause should have been granted. We used a peremptory. If the court finds a challenge for cause was denied improperly, then we are entitled to a new trial.
Well, in the criminal context, you would have to demonstrate that all of the peremptories got used up.
We did use.
You did use them
all. We used all our peremptories, yes, Your Honor. I want to talk now, and hoping to save some of my time, to switch and talk about the jury instruction. And this is jury instruction that was given as 27, and it's the last line of jury instruction 27. And the jury instruction is that an exercise of judgment that results in unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean that a physician was negligent. I think that there are a number of problems with this jury instruction. First and foremost, I think that it is misleading and confusing, and a misleading and confusing jury instruction amounts to error. What's misleading about it? Well, first off, an exercise of judgment in itself can be negligence. Anytime a physician, a radiologist, reads a diagnostic image, they're making an exercise of judgment as to what's on that image. Their exercise of that judgment can be negligence in and of itself. Used to be on the defense side. One of the cases I handled on the defense side was a liposuction case. The claim was that the physician removed too much fat. Well, the defense was that how much to remove is an issue of judgment, and it's not judgment is not negligence. The problem with this jury instruction is that it undermines the basic way that these cases are tried and what these cases are about. And what these cases are about is whether the doctor violated the applicable standard of care, whether the doctor did something that a reasonable physician in that specialty should not do under those circumstances.
Doesn't all this instruction say that an unsuccessful outcome does not mean a violation of standard of care?
No, because what's above this instruction is exactly that statement. That statement is directly above this instruction. It was part of this instruction, and I'm not challenging that. What I'm challenging is that merely because you can couch whatever the doctor does in judgment excludes it from the province of negligence.
What was the particular language again that you're challenging?
An exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean that a physician was negligent.
Does not by itself. Don't forget to address those qualifying words.
I understand that, and that's part of the problem, is that there's nothing that defines what the by itself is in any of the jurisprudence that converts an exercise of judgment from being non-negligent to negligent. If all we're looking at is whether the exercise of judgment should be judged by the standard of care instruction, then this instruction is meaningless and doesn't add anything. That's part of the confusion. If this instruction means that the jury is supposed to take the exercise in judgment and do something with it to reach its conclusion, that's not included in here. This instruction doesn't give the jury any guidance as to how they're supposed to view exercises in judgment. And what you get is what we got on closing. And what we got on closing was, and there are a few paragraphs, and I'll have to do them very quickly. One of them was Mr. Miller asserting that, and this was all new, all this was about was an exercise in judgment, and that's not negligence. The next paragraph was to the next jury verdict instruction, which says that a physician has an obligation to use their best judgment in choosing between alternatives. So this instruction doesn't have to do with alternatives. This instruction on its own goes ahead and removes judgment from the purview of negligence. It doesn't add or clarify what the jury is supposed to do. It doesn't direct the jury to addressing judgment in terms of the standard of care. And if the jury had been instructed correctly, they would have found negligence. They would not have gone ahead and allowed this exercise in judgment to be non-negligent, and there is testimony from all the doctors that Loretta Day's injuries were caused as a result of these surgeries. So if the jury found that the surgery was negligently offered or negligently performed absent this judgment, we would have prevailed, and the case should be reversed and remanded. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. You have almost a minute and a half.
May it please the court. My name is David Yoon, and my registration number is 23448. I represent defendant appellee Dr. Bruce Johnson. In this case, plaintiffs have raised three discretionary rulings made by the trial court during the course of the trial. One is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying plaintiff's challenge for cause as to juror number 14. Second is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying plaintiff's challenge for cause as to juror number 9. And the third issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion in giving a stock instruction from the Colorado Pattern Instruction 15.4. This court reviews challenges for cause for abuse of discretion. The Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that challenges for cause are a factual determination are entrusted to the trial court's sound discretion. Both the issue of whether juror number 14 had an interest in the outcome of the case under Rule 47E5 and the issue of whether juror number 9 had bias under Rule 47E7 are reviewed under the abuse of discretion standard because they are factual determination.
And isn't there a legal determination involved here, counsel, like what is meant by or covered by interested in the action?
Yes, there is that. But in determining the statements as a whole and determining whether that qualifies as an interest in the event of the action or the main question involved in the action, that is a factual determination that the trial court can make within its discretion.
What is or should be covered by the term phrase interested in the action?
Well, Colorado case law, there are a few cases, but they don't define exactly what that means. It appears to be a direct or actual interest in the outcome of the case. For example, the courts have held that a prospective juror's debtor-creditor relationship, a insured-insurer relationship, a past business relationship with one of the parties alone is not sufficient to qualify as an interest in the outcome of the case. And so I think there's two issues. One, do you have some sort of relationship and interest? And then does that interest, I mean, is the outcome of the case affecting the that particular interest? In this case, juror number 14 cannot even establish that she had an interest within the meaning of 47E5. She admitted that she never met Dr. Johnson. She never she never worked for Dr. Johnson. And she said she didn't know whether she would work for him in the future. She
talked about a concern, though, didn't she? About having a concern about working with him
yes,
in the future?
Yes, she speculated that the jury service in this case may or may not have repercussion in her future employment as a nurse in Pueblo.
In Pueblo?
Yes.
So not the Denver metropolitan area, for
yes.
instance, but a much smaller town like Pueblo.
Yes.
Did she ever disavow a concern about being a jury?
Yes, she did. Well,
town?
Let me first tell you exactly what she said also, and then go through the questions that were posed by defense counsel. She repeatedly said, I can't see into my future. I don't know whether serving on the jury would have a negative impact. I am a little bit concerned. And then when defense counsel asked the entire jury panel the following questions, she never acknowledged it. For example, if defense counsel asked the entire panel, anybody else who feels like they can't be fair, they have a bias that they they're just not going to be able to overcome. Juror number 14 never raised her hand. When defense
partial, I'm sorry, did you want to finish your thought?
Well, there are other questions that were asked similarly, and she never acknowledged this after the initial answers about her being a little bit concerned. Defense counsel had opportunity to ask questions and asked the entire panel, can you overcome your biases? Anybody having a problem with that? No one raised their hand. For example, there was another question. Anybody going to have difficulty following the court's instruction? She never raised her hand. Anybody who has problems being fair in this case and deciding this case based on the evidence? She never raised her hand. And I think that is a disavowalment of her prior statement.
The juror's assurance of impartiality, though, is only one criterion to be considered under 47E5, right? It's weighed against other factors, isn't it, which might inherently produce prejudice. That's how I read the Blades case. Did you?
The case law seems to, under the E7, I'm sorry, the bias provision, suggests to me that even if the juror expresses initially bias in favor of one party or the other, if the juror later says, I can be fair and impartial and follow the court's instructions, that is sufficient and gives the court the discretion to accept those assurances and deny the challenge for cause. And I believe a case, for example, Freeman versus Kaiser, that happened for one of the prospective jurors. One of the prospective jurors expressed that both himself and his family use Kaiser and would have difficulty rendering a verdict against Kaiser. And later, the juror said, I could set aside those concerns and reach a verdict against Kaiser, and the Court of Appeals found that that's sufficient assurances to affirm the denial of challenge for cause.
Well, but aren't we also weighing and looking at whether or not we can determine if she was unconsciously influenced by considerations in addition to the evidence?
Well, I think the trial judge looks at the entire statement, and one of the reasons that the discretion is so high, and Colorado courts have characterized it as a very high discretion, is because challenges for cause often turn on prospective jurors' body language, demeanor, sincerity, and the trial judge is in the best position to assess those qualities.
Isn't that under E6 and 7? Aren't under E1 through 5, aren't those have to do, regardless of what the juror assures or says or might even be sincere about it, if you fall within those categories, you are dismissed for cause because of an implied bias?
If there was a question, for example, are you old enough, and they don't meet the 18 age, that's clear.
Are you interested in the action? If you
qualify, but in this case, do you have an interest in the outcome of the case? Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that question is not a yes or no question. That is a factual determination. And case law suggests that there has to be an existing relationship, debtor-creditor, or insured-insurer relationship or interest, and then the case outcome has to affect that relationship. That's what the case law suggests. So it's more than, and in order to make that kind of assessment, it's a factual determination. And just because a juror said, I'm a little bit concerned about my future prospect, without never having even met Dr. Johnson, or what ramification would have later, is just pure speculation. And she wasn't greatly concerned. She said a little bit, and down the road, when defense counsel was asking questions, she never brought it up again. And when specifically asked, are you going to have a difficulty serving, she didn't raise her hand again. And I think those are the things that the trial judge has to judge.
But here's my concern. Where is the line between the juror having this speculation, as you're describing it, and the juror being unconsciously influenced by this concern that you characterize as speculation? I mean, if she's unconsciously being influenced by it, that's not proper to have a juror sit in that situation either, is it?
Well, whether or not she was unconsciously concerned, it seems to me, rather than an appellate court determining by reviewing the record saying she's unconsciously concerned, it's better for the trial judge, who's actually sitting there looking at her, you know, face to face, to be able to make that assessment. It's kind of difficult just to, you know, pick one statement here or there and then say, hey, she's unconsciously concerned. I think you have to look at the whole record as a whole, and the trial judge is in the best position to make that assessment, and she did make that assessment. And this court, I believe, has to give deference to that determination.
Counsel, do you know if the term, you know, interested in the outcome of the action or interested in the action, do you know if that has a parallel provision, say, in the federal rules?
There is not, Your Honor. There is discussion in federal court regarding whether employment, and I cited one of those cases. The court said the fact that a prospective juror had a past or an employment relationship, one of the party alone, is not sufficient to disqualify that juror. But there's no federal counterpart to 4785.
But about the future prospect of employment?
No Colorado court has said a future prospect is an interest in the outcome of the case. And there are the cases that we cited in our brief, I believe, are pretty much all of it. All the cases discussing the interest on the part of the jury.
Did you get a chance to look outside of Colorado to see what other courts?
I did look at the federal cases, but I have not found any similar state rule like the Colorado. I'm not saying there isn't any, but I have not found any. And going to the jury instruction, stock number 15.4, it is not an error in judgment instruction. All it says is an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome by itself does not mean a physician was negligent. That particular concept is supported by long-standing Colorado law, and this court has said that a jury instruction that matches the pattern instruction approved by the Supreme Court is presumed to be correct, and that is a correct statement of law. It doesn't refer to anything about mistake or error. It doesn't say a physician is insulated or not liable if he makes a mistake or error in judgment. It says nothing of that sort. It just talks about how an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome by itself does not mean negligence. And that instruction has to be read as a whole along with other instruction. And the standard of care instruction was 31. And it's clear when you read those two instructions together that a physician's conduct still has to be measured against what a reasonable physician in the same specialty would or would not do under the same or similar circumstances. So for that reason, it was not an error. And more importantly, in order to reverse on an instruction error, the plaintiff has to show that it would have affected the outcome of the case. That is, there were 30-some instructions. We're talking about one sentence in jury instruction number 27. There was overwhelming evidence that Dr. Johnson was not negligent in recommending surgery, not negligent in performing surgery, and that the intubation that occurred after the surgery and not Dr. Johnson's conduct was the cause of the Mrs. Day's vocal cord injury. So when you consider all of the evidence and all of the instructions, a one sentence in jury instruction number 27 could not possibly have affected the outcome of the case. For all of those reasons, we ask the court to affirm the judgment. Unless the court has any other questions, we stand by our briefs on the remaining issue that was not raised by plaintiff's counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Yoon. Rebuttal, counsel?
Yes.
As concerns the juror, there is nothing attacking her concern as being illegitimate. It is a legitimate concern. While there may have been questions about does anyone else feel that they can't be fair, that doesn't address whether this juror who's expressed her concerns views herself as that anyone else. And I don't have the exact language of that portion of the, and didn't have an opportunity to review while Mr. Yoon was speaking, but to the extent that there's a generalized question to the jury about can anyone else or anyone else have concerns, this juror has talked and spoken and assessed and addressed her concerns. The interest in the action is not defined by the cases that exist. What's defined is what's not an interest in the action, and that is a debtor-creditor relationship, a past business relationship, past relationships that are set out where the legal interests are clearly established, an insurance-insured relationship. Those contractual relationships or those past relationships are not the kind of relationships that the court has held create bias. What's concerning here is that this is a future relationship where this juror has indicated she sees herself at risk. That she should have been dismissed for cause, and that she wasn't is reversible error. And I stand on the briefs and the other arguments as concerns the remaining issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.